Good afternoon. I'd like to call a meeting of the House Resource Committee to order at 1:02 p.m. We're in room 124. Today is Wednesday, March the 30th, 2016. Our members present are Representative Josephson, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative Olson, Representative Chenault, my fellow co-chair, Representative Nagiak, and I'm Representative Tallarico, co-chair of the committee. I'd like to let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I'd also like to recognize our staff. Our secretary is Julie Kohler. Our teleconference aide is Matt Kern. Thank you both for being here today. And committee aide is Julie Morris from my office right up here. I'd like to remind everyone to please turn off or silence your cell phones, please. Today we're going to hear Senate Bill 125, House Bill 282, which is AGDC Board. We're also going to hear, once again, House Bill 253, the mining tax, and we do have some amendments that we'll be going through as well. If we have time, we will get to House Bill 286, which are the fish and game violations. So with that, I would, in the interest of time, and we do appreciate some folks being here to present for us. So if the sponsor for Senate Bill 125 would like to come forward, and staff, if you so choose, please introduce yourself for the record and give us a presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Tallarico. I'm Senator, and members of the committee, I'm Senator Mia Costello. I represent the Senate District, West Anchorage, and with me today is my senior staff, Weston Eiler, who is here to assist if there's any questions for the bill.
Thank you, and I'd like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Representative Herron.
So thank you for hearing this bill. It Senate Bill 125 is a straightforward bill. It adds two legislators as non-voting ex officio members to the Board of Directors of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, one from the Senate appointed by the Senate President and one from the House appointed by the Speaker of the House. Mr. Co-Chair, AGDC is the state's primary representative in the AKLNG project and will be a focal point for significant policy decisions in the coming years. The board currently consists of five public members appointed by the governor and two commissioners of state departments, but not Department of Revenue or DNR, which brings the total number of board members from 7 to 9 if this bill were to pass. The importance of the gas line, Mr. Co-Chair, cannot be understated. I mean, Alaskans are following this project. We get regular updates, and last session, you know, we received updates from AGDC. It's a generational project. It will be one of the largest engineering projects in the world. This bill will help facilitate communication and teamwork between the legislature and the AGDC board to help move this important project forward. Given the importance of the project, there is a need for transparent and clear decision making. The best way to make these decisions is to give all parties a seat at the state's table. Having legislators on the board is an asset. It provides perspective and institutional knowledge and continuity. Six of the seven AGDC board seats have turned over in the past year, Mr. Co-Chair. There is precedent for having legislators serve on and advise state boards. Legislators currently serve on over a dozen state boards and commissions, including the Knik Armbridge Authority, the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Each has two legislators as non-voting ex officio members. The fact that legislators would serve as non-voting members alleviates any constitutional concerns. This bill will improve collaboration and communication on a project that will help move Alaska forward in terms of AKLNG. The AGDC's mission and authority have expanded greatly during the past 6 years. And originally, it was a simple subsidiary of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation tasked with studying a small-diameter in-state gas line. It's evolved to being the focal point of state decision-making on developing a liquefied natural gas on behalf of the state. It's important that the way organizations like this are structured be able to adapt to the types of decision-making needed for a project of this magnitude. Legislators understand the type of budgeting decisions that will be needed to meet the state's cash calls, and it would be helpful for discussions of the AGC board to have two legislators there to listen and participate in those discussions. Having legislators at the table also lets policymakers better understand AGDC and the board's view of the business decisions facing the state. Again, the gas line is one of the most important projects that we have before us. This bill will further cooperation and teamwork and collaboration between the members of AGDC board now and the legislature. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Committee, any questions for the sponsor? Representative Seaton and then Representative Josephs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've dealt with an issue very similar to this in just the previous committee this morning. We were looking at that holding dual office requirement prohibition under the Constitution, and having legislative members in the executive department. And I'm wondering how you address those issues as well.
Thank you, through the chair. So the bill was amended on the Senate side to state that legislators will not be paid per diem and they will not be receiving any sort of financial benefit from this. I am aware of several memos that address the concerns that you bring up. My response to that is that if you really are looking at separation of powers among the branches, then it is the judicial branch that would weigh in as to whether or not there's a constitutionality issue with that. So by virtue of the argument you're trying to promote, you then should, you know, recognize that it's really not the legislative branch that should be deciding judicial issues of constitutionality, but it is the judicial branch. And we, as I mentioned in my remarks, there is precedent for legislators sitting on boards and corporations included. And so if that is an issue, that might be something that is taken up as a group then.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. If there were legislative members on the board and many of the things they'd be discussing would require confidentiality, would the legislators be able to or be anticipated to sign confidentiality statements? And then how would they share information back with us?
Thank you, through the chair. Currently, I'm aware of only one member of AGDC board currently that has signed a confidentiality statement. And so if it's not an issue for the members that are currently on the board, I don't see why it would be an issue for the ex officio members.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Senator Costello. The Kabata, which I think has a new name, but anyway, that organization, Aerospace and ASME, are their members appointed by the executive branch, or I'm trying to recall how that works.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I'm not certain on that. I do believe they're appointed by the leadership in the House and the Senate.
Okay.
Follow-up?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator, is there a competing legal opinion from any source to the one in front of me from Mr. Jude of March 20th.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if you consider a state court as a competing legal opinion, then yes, there is. North Carolina versus the Transportation Infrastructure Board, that court decided in favor of ex officio members of the legislature sitting on, ex officio members who also serve in the legislature serving on the board. And so state courts are currently split on that issue that you bring up.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you. If we would have the appointees and that was challenged and that would go through probably a long legal process, would that mean that AGDC would either be at risk of having any of their decisions overturned or would not be able to make any decisions until that was solved?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'd prefer that question be answered by somebody else, but again, these members are ex officio and non-voting, so any decision, if this bill were to pass, any decision that was made by the board would be made by the voting members of the board and not the two listening, participating members of the legislature who are there simply to have a seat at the table. And again, you know, the spirit in which the bill has been offered is for cooperation and communication. And so I don't see why that would be an issue, but that's something that you may want to ask another testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Costello, you talked about how the AGDC has evolved, but what I'm wondering is in its present iteration, that happened in 2013 as part of SB 21, is that right? So whatever is part of the argument that section, I guess, of SB 21 needs reform, or is the statute that created AGDC, was that unimpacted by, let me think about this, maybe it was House Bill 4, but at any rate, it was 2013.
Through the chair, if I might, Representative Josephson, for the record, Weston Eiler, staff to Senator Costello. Representative Josephson, I believe you're referring to the changes that were made to AGDC with passage of Senate Bill 138. This would have been in 2014. Okay. That outlines and structures the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation as it's currently arranged.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, so it's on the record. What was the catalyst and what is the need for this legislation?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Herron, last session it became evident that the communication and transparency amongst the parties, the interested parties, which I consider to be all Alaskans, it was brought to our attention that it could be improved. And so again, the impetus for this bill is to help with the communication. We also have a board that has changed over. Certainly, if there were two legislators sitting on this board as ex officio, listening, participating members, it would, I feel, add to the conversation. And we've heard from members of the legislature who currently sit on other boards and corporations that their participation is viewed as aiding the discussion and an asset to the corporation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Josephson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sometime, I believe, in the September to October timeframe, there was a lot of focus in the public, in newspapers, and in our collective work on AGDC, some of the turnover you discussed, that sort of thing. And so Representative Tarr and I, separately but on the same day, went to an AGDC meeting. There were a number of members of your body there. I hadn't been back. I guess what I'm wondering is there any reflection in attendance by the 60 legislators of interest in those meetings as they're happening? Because there were about four elected officials that day. I remember Senator Giesel being there, I think. I'm just curious whether people's interest in AGDC's work is reflected by attendance at their meetings.
Thank you, Representative Josephson, through the chair. There's extreme interest in what's happening at the AGDC meetings. I have personally read every public document that is available. However, they do go into executive session, and those discussions, as you know, are confidential and not open to the purview by anybody. And as the people's branch, I think that it is incumbent on us for a project of this magnitude to be there. And we see many boards that are very large in their size, and so this addition is focuses mainly. I mean, I hear the concerns focusing mainly on the role of the legislature and our participation, but I also want to mention that the role of the project, the scope of the project, is of such magnitude that it warrants a legislative view.
Any other questions? Thank you, Senator. And I guess if I could just add, and maybe you can respond to this or not if you choose, but it certainly would appear in a non-voting, uncompensated capacity that this doesn't even appear to be advisory as much as just trying to make sure that we have a communication line open so that we have just that better transparency and better communication between the legislature and the board. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I think that was your intent with this legislation. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yes, and I also want to mention that it is common practice worldwide on corporations to have what you would consider viewing members or participatory members that do not vote, but are there just as part of the discussion and listening. And so I see it as a transparency and communication bill.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no problems with adding the legislators, particularly because the role we would have would be as, you know, non-voting members. The only trouble I can see is that if they go into an executive session and the legislative members are able to participate in that, there's no mechanism for that information to be shared with other legislators. And that, I just don't know if there's a way around that or if that is anything that we can work through. And I don't necessarily think that's the reason to stop, you know, this bill from going forward. But I guess I just wonder if there's a way, because I think if they were participating and we did clearly have communication breakdown and lack of everybody on the same page. But I just wonder if there's a way we could, you know, make that an even greater asset for the legislature in the sense that they could then, you know, perhaps through executive session of our own, you know, learn some of that information. And I don't know if that's something that has come up or you have considered.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I mean, I have considered it the ex officio non-voting legislative participants would be under the same, you know, guidelines as the rest of the board, so they wouldn't necessarily be able to share that. So it is a confidence-building effort to have our branch of government, the people's branch, in those meetings.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator, thank you very much. We do appreciate your time, and I know that you've got a very busy schedule, so thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And we'll take just a brief at ease. Back on the record, and we're going to have 282 presented to us by the sponsor and staff. So, gentlemen, if you could please introduce yourselves for the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Representative Chenault. I represent the northern part of the Kenai Peninsula. Mr. Chairman, you've already heard this bill has really two provisions in it. The first provision you've just heard. Basically, we mirror what the good senator from Anchorage had spoke to you just recently about. Mr. Chairman, this bill also has a second provision in it, and the second provision amends AS 31.25.020B, and it requires the governor to appoint four of the five board members that have experience and expertise in natural gas pipeline construction, operation, marketing, finance, large project management, or other expertise and experience that is relevant to the purpose, powers, and duties of AGDC. One of the board members is not required to have the expertise previously outlined in this paragraph, but the original language, which was established under SB 138 for board member appointment qualifications, was permissive. The board currently consists of the five public members and two departmental commissioners, the two commissioners from DOR and DNR are prohibited from serving on the board. Mr. Chairman, the original intent of, and I'll give you a brief history. Some of us have been here, but I'll give you a brief history. The original intent of House Bill 369, House Bill 4, House Bill 9, and Senate Bill 138 was to have a board free from political interference and influence and to make decisions based on the state's and AGDC's best interests. However, this has changed in the last few years. Most of the board members, who I do respect, do not have the qualifications of previous board members, nor have the expertise that was sought under Senate Bill 138. Once pre-feed is completed, and if the decision is made to advance to feed, it is imperative that the board be comprised of members that provide the best expertise available. The governor has stated in requesting the resignation of the original president of AGDC that the executive of the corporation have the ability to take AGDC in a new to the next level. And the same should be true of the board, Mr. Chairman. So with that, we'll try to answer any questions that you may have, and I'll let my staff introduce himself.
For the record, Tom Wright, staff to Speaker Chenault. In response to one of the questions asked by Representative Joseph, and that court case was in South Carolina. It was South Carolina Public Interest Foundation and Edward D. Sloan v. South Carolina Transportation Infrastructure Bank. That's about the only court case that we've been able to dig up that actually discusses the issue of having legislators serve as non-voting members. There are no that we were able to find any Alaska court cases that dealt with this. The other issue is talking about the non-voting members. You know, I guess in my mind, if the administration was concerned about that, they'd have legislation out there to discuss ASME. And by the way, there are no statutes that specifically state that ASME have legislators serving on that board. But, you know, as far as Kabata and the aerospace corporation, if this was a concern, then I would expect to see legislation from the administration addressing this.
Thank you. Any questions? No questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson, then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either gentleman,
use the term loosely.
31. So the existing statute on the governing body for AGDC is only advisory. It says, please appoint, you know, it says when appointing, the governor shall consider, and then it hits a lot of the expertise you want. Your amendment basically requires that that expertise be there for sure. Is that the essence of it?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Wright again. Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just haven't gone over the bill before now, so sorry. I'm trying to figure out the existing board. Is this all proactive, or is it retrospective as well to for board members that may not have the qualifications? Are they then? Is there a termination clause in here for board members that might be on the board that don't have the qualifications we're requiring?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, it's our intent that the current board members stay, but you know, when new appointments come up, that you know, that the qualifications be part of the consideration when nominating somebody.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't able to find it in the bill.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen, for the presentation. We're going to hold this, and my plan is to generate a committee substitute utilizing both of these bills that we have in front of us so that we can bring it back. We'll bring it back soon, I think. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could just under quick comment.
Representative Josephson, quick comment.
Sure. The opinions that were offered are what are called persuasive opinions. They're from out of state. They can have some authority, carry some weight, but they generally are not persuasive relative to Alaska decisions. The Attorney General cites two Alaska decisions and three Attorney General's opinions. and says that even non-voting status is a problem. So if there's a workaround for that, I'm intrigued by the bill.
Thank you. Representative Tarr, one more comment, and then we're moving along.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And I just spoke with the Senate sponsor, and I'll work with Speaker Chenault, perhaps. I would be interested in just maybe, you know, if we can address the issue of whether we can have these members added, actually maybe having a majority and minority member added to as non-voting members. So I'll follow up with the respective offices on that matter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We, like I said, we will set it aside, and we will develop a committee substitute that we can look at a, in a future date, very near future date, I hope. So we're going to move to House Bill 253, the mining tax, and we adopted a committee substitute on Monday, I believe, and I'd ask for amendments, and I appreciate those folks getting those to us on time. So, first of all, are there any questions about the CS that we did? Does everybody has a copy of that, or at least it's fresh in our memory, I think, that we had the CS. So, yeah.
My brain, Mr. Chairman.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. So we're going to start with the amendments. I believe you all have a packet. And yeah. And I think we had... with a correction in the first one that we were going to have, we'll let Representative Seaton maybe we'll start that process. Representative Seaton, if you'd like to go ahead and move that amendment, you can explain to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move a new amendment number one, which would be N.15.
Okay, amendment number one has been moved. Is there an objection?
Object for discussion.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, first of all, the reason for the new is that on page 2, line 11, those references that were being replaced from the old bill numbering, they had inadvertently got some of those switched around, so they didn't have the correct section referred to. So that's the only change between the new and the original amendment. Mr. Chairman, this is relating to production royalties on mining, and royalty is one of those things we talked about in our discussions. So this is looking at following fees and in the title relating to production tax royalties. Really, the meat of the amendment goes to Section 5, and that's where royalty is recalculated from 3% of net profit to 3% of either net smelter return or the gross value at the point of production. And the reason there's two different definitions on there is because the minerals coming out of mines are handled in two different ways, this establishes how that's done. Section 6 establishes what net smelter return is. That is when the mineral goes into a smelter and then it comes out as a finished product. There's an amount that's subtracted, of course, for the processing fees, and what comes out is the value, whether that's gold or anything else, at that point of production. The Section 7 defines gross value at the point of production, and those calculations are different because many times mines ship concentrates. A product that hasn't gone through a smelter that may be sold at that point. And anyway, at that point, when it's coming out off of the mine and being shipped, that's the gross value at the point of production is established there. And, you know, Section, there's a lot more verbiage in there in the sections on net smelter returns and gross value at the point of production, but all those are is saying this has to really be an arm's-length transaction so that it's like a transaction between two different parties or two different people or two different companies. If you're selling it to yourself, you can't declare all the loss in an inappropriate place or expenses that are not appropriate. So that's the other verbiage in there under gross value at point of production. And then sections 1 to 4 are in here because as we went forward and discussed the bill before, royalty is our ownership value in the minerals that are there. And it's inappropriate to have a tax credit applied against our ownership value. And so that would be exploration tax credits could be applied against taxes, whether that's the mining license tax or whether that's against corporate income tax, but that it shouldn't reduce the value of our portion of the minerals. And so that's the that's what amendment number one does.
Okay, are there any questions? Okay. Well, we'll see if anybody has any questions. I have a question that, and I don't want to put Mr. Fogles on the spot, but we do have him here as a reference, I think, about the gross value at the point of production, and exactly what how do we determine that? Since there's, I know there's a lot of processing from, I'll say, pit to transportation system, so I'm not exactly sure. If how clearly that's defined.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. My name is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I think that's probably one of our issues that we have at this point is the Department of Natural Resources does not track these costs at this point. So we don't know how we would actually determine these values at this point. That would have to be something that we would have to, you know, determine as we go forward. But that's not something that, that DNR tracks, and we don't have the expertise right now to figure that out.
So, Mr. Fogles, to some degree, would you be reliant on the producer to I can think of a particular product that, although it may seem like it's wildly profitable, it is after it's crushed, screened, belted, transported, and then sold, and of course all of those costs. I think there potentially is an argument that's not the point of production. The point of production is actually pulling it out of the ground. So I'm wondering, you know, everything beyond what I just said, all those things I just mentioned are value added to the product. So is there an argument you think that could be poised that this is point of production, and this is processed product or value-added product. I don't know if I'm being very clear, but
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I'm in a position to be able to answer that. I mean, I do know that if this were to go forward, we would have to rely on, you know, the operator to tell us what those costs are on either side, and then, you know, as to how we verify them or audit them somewhere down the road. I don't know that, but I guess the big issue is that at this point, we would be able to give you a clear picture of what the fiscal benefits of the state would be from these changes, or you know, or the impact to the operator at this point. So,
okay, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you'd look on page 4, lines 7 through 10, it's addressing exactly what you're talking about, except as provided in C, this section, the value of a resource immediately after its removal from the mine is the price received by the person engaged in mining of the resource, adjusted for the value added after the resource was produced. So that value added is subtracted from that, and then in C are the price received by the person is accepted unless it's rejected for one of the reasons: the price is less than the fair market value, the price is less than and does not reflect the total value received by the seller in the transaction, the parties in the transaction are affiliated, or the price received was not negotiated arm's length transaction by the seller. So it's exactly as you were outlining the in all of these tax cases, including oil taxes, the producer is going to tell us what the costs are, and then those are audited. Unless they are unreasonable or unfair, then they would be rejected. But other than that, the state has an audit procedure and not evaluation determining feature under the way this bill is crafted. So that's the entire section C is giving the parameters of what of how you could not accept a price that the producer said this was the value of the material, and here are my costs, and here is here's the price I received for this material. And then further on page four, going down from D, it's if the department rejects the price reported, then they'll substitute fair market value, but they'll have to have reasoning for doing that. They'll have to have substantiation that the value is less than fair market value or any of those conditions. So that's what we're considering in the bill for the determining the value of the material so that we can calculate our royalty.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair for Mr. Fogles. Although the accounting that would be called for under this amendment is different than what the division is doing now, to achieve and inspect a net profit value, the division already has to look at all sorts of different information and documents, doesn't it? So in terms of the, although this is a different approach, in terms of that sort of analysis, it's something, it's arduous, I'm sure, but it's something that your department has to do now, or the, I guess the other department, revenue, has to do.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I really haven't pecked this apart with staff to the nitty-gritty of what they'd have to do, but clearly, as I read this, there's a lot more involved here that we would have to be looking at in order to determine whether, the amounts declared by the operator were in fact true or not. I think you're right, and some of that information we're already trying to collect, but probably not all of it.
For the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director for the Tax Division. Currently, the Tax Division does review those records because it's just a percentage of the net tax calculated in our division. So we share that information. We have a memorandum of understanding. We provide, DNR provides us with a list of royalty recipients that they want to have that information for. We give them the net income, and they just take the 3% of that. So it would be, someone would have to do a lot more work under this, because as I read the amendment, it's only applies to the royalty, and therefore tax wouldn't. Mm.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you. Through the chair for Mr. Spanos. Even if there is additional work, the testimony on the third day of this bill, which was the 19th of February, was that royalty on private land using net smelter returns in Alaska was 4.5%, and that royalty on mental health trust land using net smelter return was 5%. I'm just wondering, although this bill began by the administration as a 28% or 2 numerical percent point increase, what's been identified and was echoed by Representative Hawker when he was here on February 15th, is that, I don't want to paraphrase what he said and get it wrong, but the essence of it was that royalty was this pure thing and we need to get it right. Would this amendment help us do that?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I'm not sure that I'm qualified to to answer the question. Certainly, it's a different calculation that on its face would appear fair, but I'm not sure that I'm the guy to answer that.
So currently, Mr. Spanos, what you're saying is you're structured right now to do exactly what we do with these mines as far as tax collection in the tax division. and to structure this, at least in your opinion, you would see a reasonably large added expense to, or more expense at least involved in.
Mr. Co-Chair, I'm not sure that what I was saying was tax would no longer be of assistance to Department of Natural Resources in order to provide information to help them get to their final number. Whether there's additional expense or not is really up to DNR to determine. But the way that they get to their 3% currently is we do the work and we provide them with those numbers.
Any other questions, comments?
Yeah, I've got a question.
Representative Herron.
I guess it's just an open question. I mean, we're talking about relating to production royalties on mining. Can we have an example? I mean, can we have an example? I don't care which one we use, and so we know what the state gets out of this change. Use any example. It doesn't matter to me. Real dollars.
Mr. Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, we have Pogo Mine is on state land. That's right. Pogo Mine in 2014 produced 342,147 ounces of gold, approximately 3% of net smelter return would be $13,942. So we're talking in the range of this tax being able to generate a somewhat equal amount that the fish tax increase is generating. These two industries are both large. They're both expansive across the state. You know, the fishing industry employs the most. The mining industry has the highest wages in the state. So we have two large industries. But that's remember this on royalty only applies to those mines on state land. But it's our ownership value on that would relate to. So one of the problems we've had is that we haven't been getting an ownership share. We've been getting a net profit share. And the question is, if someone is inefficient or has high expenses, doesn't control their expenses, should we get less value for the minerals, our ownership of those minerals that are extracted, or should it be on a value of the minerals? And, you know, that's a policy call. It's generally a policy call that we've made on oil and gas, and it's 12.5% minimum royalty. That's the value that's extracted. And it's not dissimilar to oil and gas, because you have certain things that are taken in production tax, and you have a point of production, and you can subtract those upstream costs. It doesn't mean that you're like your corporate income tax, where you can take all the expenses off. This is done all the time, looking at well lease credits. I mean, that means there has to be a computation of well lease expenditures, those that are qualified. And this is no different than that. I mean, just because the departments have not been currently doing the calculation or haven't been bothered collecting the numbers, there's no reason to collect the numbers when we had a based on total profit, and they only collected the total profit number, not the intermediate number, and not allowing all of the other extraneous expenses to be considered. And this is one of the same reasons why Representative Hawker, you know, his point was we should not be allowing tax credits be taken off against the royalty, because that is our ownership value and we shouldn't be reducing it. But if our ownership value is just a profit-based value, then that's not based on our ownership. It's based on their efficiency of production. And so that's, I guess this is in, I hope that's answering your question.
Follow up. So to add to Commissioner, is What is the administration's view on this proposed amendment?
Representative Heron, through the chair, at this point, we've had some discussions on this concept, and this amendment was just floated today, and I don't think that I'm prepared to give an administration's viewpoint on support or oppose on this, and it's something that we need to look at in a little more detail.
So a follow-up to that is, it's a more general question. How come we haven't done this before?
Representative Heron, through the chair, the 3% royalty was enacted by statute in 1989. Our staff back then did some economic modeling to determine that that royalty rate. It was set back then, and there just has never been any cause to have DNR or I guess revenue or any other state agency to relook at the royalty structure. And as to why, I don't know, but I know that we haven't really been asked to take another look at it in those intervening years, to my knowledge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you do any modeling in the next week or two, could you forward it to the co-chairs?
Yes, sir, I will.
Representative Seaton.
Could we have the tax division comment on this bill as well? I mean, we had them come forward to bring the bill forward, so whoever's working on that most appropriately.
Because I don't get to push it down too far. I can't push it up. Commissioner's not here. For the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. This is an issue that I know that our commissioner and previous commissioners have looked at and talked to Representative Seaton about, something that we've committed to looking at in the future. It's kind of a short period of time between now and the end of the session. The concept is correct in the terms of an ownership percentage, similar to other things. So structurally, we would think that this is a rational way to go, but it is kind of there's some information that we don't have at this point. Mm-hmm. His estimate, the Senator or Representative Seaton's estimate of $13 million may or may not be, it's not an exact number, and it may be more or less than that. So I think we need to have time to do this, and this is not really the time when we have the resources to commit to doing that further analysis.
Okay, time is not on our side for
right.
Sure. And this does seem to be quite a departure from the bill that the administration brought to us. Substantially different, would you say? Okay. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, is your objection maintained, Representative Heron? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that this is a very important concept. We've got it out on the table. I think that this needs to be worked on. And if the department doesn't have the time or the expertise to do that now, I'd be willing to withdraw this amendment so that we can address this at a future time. But I think that it's a very important part of the conversation, because our ownership share is not being realized through a net profit. So I'd withdraw the amendment.
Withdraw the amendment. Thank you. Amendment number one is withdrawn. We will move on to amendment number two. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chairman, amendment number two is trying to work on the same problem of the royalty. And this replaces the royalty with the 3% severance tax, which is an easier calculation than either net smelter return or gross value at the point of production. And I think that's a valuable consideration to have. Still gets us to basically the same amount, except that the way the amendment happened to be crafted, it's across the all across the state, all mines, and so it really doesn't hit the royalty. And so for the technical reasons that this amendment is removing royalty and we are required by law to have royalty, I'm going to withdraw amendment number two, but I wanted it on the table for discussion so that if there's future conversations, structuring a royalty upon a severance tax format would be something that we should consider if people are thinking that a net smelter return or value at point of production would be too difficult. So, thank you. I'll withdraw.
Withdraw amendment number two. Thank you, Representative Seaton. Amendment number three, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move amendment number three.
Amendment number three has been moved. Is there an objection?
Object for discussion.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Herron has done an objection. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment establishes a legislative working group. I think we've all found that the mining taxes, whether it's royalty or rents or mining license fees, all of those things are quite confusing. It's going to take a little longer dive than we have to get it right. It hasn't been really redone since statehood and to a significant way. And so just in parallel with the Cookinland Working Group that we established under consideration oil taxes, this establishes a legislative working group to study the tax structure of mining. I think that this would be the way for us to really come back and for the industry to be involved, to for both the both bodies of the legislature to be involved, to bring the administration to the table in other than a very quick reactive way, but actually to craft something that would be good for the legislature. So that's what this amendment does. And if the form seems familiar, it's almost exactly what we had from our oil and gas tax consideration and the problems we have in Cook Inlet, and us acknowledging that we needed a deeper dive for those changes.
Discussion. In committee discussion?
I withdraw my objection.
You withdraw your objection? Okay. Is there any further objection to amendment number three? Seeing none, amendment number three is adopted. We will go to amendment number four. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I believe you have that new amendment number four, and that's exactly the same on page 2, line 11, that calculation that was wrong. This does not change the royalties at all. It's still the 3% net royalty, but this does just says that you can't take the tax credits against the royalty. Royalty is our ownership value, and so you can't take the tax credit to reduce our ownership value. You know, I really don't like the way the ownership value is created, but once it's created, we shouldn't be reducing that ownership value through a tax credit.
I apologize, Representative Seaton. Did you move amendment number four?
Maybe not. I'll move amendment number four.
Thank you. amendment number four has been moved. Is there an objection?
Objection.
Objection for discussion. Now we can have our discussion. Thank you.
Do I need to start over, Mr. Chairman?
Maybe give us a very brief history. My mind was racing on whether or not I'd done the procedure right. I obviously hadn't.
This is a section of the royalty bill that doesn't change royalties at all. Royalties are still calculated exactly as they are, but what it does is say you cannot use an exploration incentive tax credit to apply and reduce our ownership value in the minerals that are extracted. As I said, I don't like the way we make that calculation of ownership value, but at least we should not be allowing that to be reduced by 50% by applying a tax credit against it. It's a royalty, even though it's on net royalty, it's a royalty, and we shouldn't reduce our ownership value.
Representative Josephson.
Not a question, but a comment about the amendment.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The at the first day of this bill, this bill's hearing, which was the 15th of February, the Deputy Commissioner of Commerce, Mr. Parody, spoke very briefly. And Mr. Parody spent the better part of his career, I think, about 30-plus years working for and with the mining industry. That's what he did before he entered the Wyoming legislature. And he noted that royalty is uniquely an ownership share and should not be considered as part of government take, and that's sort of a different issue that came up with the sport industry organization. But the point I think that he makes and that was made in that committee is that it should be, as I said before, unaffected by other things, discounts, credits. We don't do that in our treatment of the oil industry, and I don't think we should do it here, and so I support the amendment.
Further discussion?
I lift my objection.
Okay. That's an objection on amendment number 4. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, amendment number 4 passes. Oh. Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, not an objection to that. Mr. Chairman, if I could maybe go back to amendment number 3 for a comment.
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make the comment fairly quickly. Page 2, line 5, it says working group is to be supported by legislative consultants under contract through the LBNA committee. Currently, at this time, there are no consultants on mining taxes, so that's an issue that if this bill does pass and this amendment stays in, that we'll have to have that discussion with the LBNA chairman to make sure that if we form this working group, that at that time we have the folks available to be able to consult with. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So noted. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And amendment number 5, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move amendment number 5.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Is there an objection?
Check.
Thank you, Representative Herring. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the purpose of this bill basically was to, that came before us, was to raise some money. And we have the CS, which took that amount from 9 down to 8. At that lower tax bracket. But what we have here is we're looking at a new tax bracket at $1 million, so significantly higher than the current structure of 8% in excess of $100,000. So, but what it does is say at these higher values, there would be one more percent. And then that would gain us back some of the revenue that the CS has lost, but it would impact many fewer players because there's quite a few players that are in that over $100,000 dollar range that would not be above the $1 million range. So it wouldn't return back all the money to the original amount, but it would be somewhat more. And I think that as we're looking at this entire legislative session we're in, this is one that I think would just affect the most profitable taxpayers. And it's a simple, I mean, there's a long ways between, it's an additional 1%, but it starts at $1 million, so that's a 10 times the value of where we started at 8%. So that's the entire amendment.
Mr. Chairman, could we have a brief at ease?
A brief at ease.
will come back on the record. And we're on amendment number 5. Representative Heron had an objection to that. And Mr. Burnett, could you come up and address this for us?
Through the chair, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I didn't hear a question yet, so I'd be happy to address the question if you have.
All right. I think Representative Heron had a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jerry, of course, you have estimated what the governor's bill would generate in revenue. Can you share with us what the difference will be between the governor, the co-chair CS, and this, and what would the amendment? Could you give us ballpark back the napkin estimates on those new revenues? And that would, Mr. Chairman, that would probably be appropriate on amendment number 6 and 7 as well when we get to those.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Heron, the difference between the governor's bill and the CS was about for next year was estimated to be about $3.2 million reduction. So from $6 point some million down to $3 point some million. We don't have a new fiscal note for it because we thought there might be some amendments offered today. This amendment would affect, based on the last year of tax filings that we had, 14 taxpayers over $100,000. In the last year, 9 of which were between $100,000 and $1 million, and the others were over $1 million. The ones that are between $100,000 and $1 million are primarily large placer miners and landowners that own part of the property under one of the larger mines. The total revenue from those 9 would be probably under a million, certainly in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So this would restore most of the revenue from the governor's bill, but would reduce the tax rate for those people between $100,000 and $1 million to 8% rather than the 9% in the original bill. Because those 9 taxpayers make significantly less revenue than the 5 largest taxpayers that are over $1 million.
Just for clarification.
Follow up.
Mr. Chairman, so this amendment is basically restores the co-chair CS amount?
To the chair, Representative Heron, it restores a majority of the money that was taken out because the 9 taxpayers that earn between $100,000 and $1 million have much less impact than the ones over $1 million in revenue.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Burnett. We may need you back. You may not want to run away. So, thank you, Representative Seaton.
So, in wrap up, you know, the purpose of this amendment is to was the purpose of the bill to generate some revenue, but the purpose of the structure of the amendment is to remove any additional burden on the majority of the smaller players that would have to pay the tax. So, it's removing the burden from the smaller players. So it just has that 9% that was in the original bill, moves that up to $1 million and above instead of at $100,000 is where the original bill was. And so it removes more than half the taxpayers from having any impact at all of this amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Seaton. Is your objection maintained?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton made me think of something. So what's the number those smaller miners, what's that number? I mean, if it's the 5 big mines would have 9%, so what is the amount of money between $100,000 and $1 million that we would generate? So we're helping out those guys. What is that amount?
To the chair, Representative Herron, I don't have the exact amount. We haven't had a chance to calculate that, but it is. It would be in the small hundreds of thousands of dollars total between all of them.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, Jerry, while you're here, did you say that this amendment would bring in additional three point some odd million?
The chair to Representative Chenault, approximately $3 million.
And that would be from the large miners, right, and not the small miners.
Right. I think we estimated 3.2 from each 1% at this level, and so it's around the $3 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further comments? And so every percentage point that we talk about is a 14.25% tax increase. Is that pretty close?
Through the Mr. Chair, every one after at seven, everyone is about a little over 14.2857 or whatever.
Okay.
It is.
All right.
But you know, next time when you go from 8 to 9, it's not so much. It's only 12 and a half.
True. That's true. Any further discussion? Is your objection maintained?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. The objection has been maintained, so if I could get the secretary to call the roll.
Amendment 5. Representative Johnson is absent. Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Tarr?
Pass.
Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Chenault?
No.
Co-Chair Tallarico?
No.
Co-Chair Nagia?
No.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
3 yay, 5 nay.
Thank you. Amendment number 5 has failed. We'll move on to amendment number 6. Representative Josephson?
I move amendment number 6.
Thank you. Amendment number 6 has been moved. Is there an objection?
Objection.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Josephson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this amendment would actually decrease rates for small mines that make under $100,000 just on the margins. Now, it wouldn't decrease all of them. It would decrease some of them. We're receiving just, I think, $51,000 from perhaps 29 mines, if I'm looking at this chart correctly. And I think that I'm okay exempting those folks. I assume some of them are hobbyists, because it would be hard to make a living. If you take the $51,000, you spread it around 29 taxpayers, it's not a lot of money. I'm sure it's meaningful to them. However, it does raise the rate, as you can see, and it raises it higher than the governor recommended. And I wanted to talk about that and make some record. For taxpayers over $100,000, there's a progressive tax rate of 5% for the $100,000 to $200,000 range. And that is, I think, comparable to what we're doing now. $7,500 plus 7% over $250,000 under the amendment. And for $250,000, there would be there would be a 7% rate. Let me look at this again. Let me start again. Over $100,000 and not over $250,000, 5%. over $250,000 and not over $500,000. It's $7,500 plus 7% of the excess over $250,000. So the existing law has a formula like this where there's this sort of smaller amount and then the percentage kicks in. Third category, over 500,000, not over a million, is 9%. That's where Representative Seaton was, although it begins at $500,000. And over $1 million, 11%. The thinking behind the amendment is a couple things. One of them is that there was testimony that for profit-based tax, net profit-based taxes, in somewhat, now I concede that as a number of witnesses testified, it's hard to get apples to line up with apples. But in South Dakota, which has a net profit system, they tax at 14%. And I think we heard in Wisconsin it was somewhat higher than our 7. I think it was 9 or 11, although I'm missing that number at the moment. The amendment is to provide a tax break for the smaller mining operations and encourage the development of small mines while increasing taxes on larger mines. In tax years 2013 and 14, the state generated $51,000 and $42,000, as I indicated before, from mines with incomes under $100,000, but generated most of its revenue from mines over $100,000. Respectively, it was $471,000 in 2013, $571 million in 2014. The effective rate works out to, by my calculation, even though it says 7%, somewhere in the neighborhood of 6.6 to 7%. When you take into consideration all revenue from all sources, the mining license tax, corporate income tax, royalty rent, the industry contributes about 3.24% of total state revenue. Alternatively, the oil industry contributes about, at today's prices, about 54%. And the concern I have is that we don't know, and I'm concerned about the true value of the concentrate. We think that that documents reflect that the value of the concentrate exceeds $2 billion. And, of course, you can't wear concentrate around your neck as a piece of jewelry. I haven't seen that. So I concede that that's it's a long way to go to processing metal. But I think relative to the other net profit states, I think that the amendment is warranted. I'm concerned that this industry, which does provide great jobs, fantastic jobs, often $90,000 and higher, that we're leaving something on the table that we don't fully appreciate or understand, and that's why I've offered the amendment. Thank you.
Any Representative Herron?
Yes. To the Commissioner Burnett, is if we were to take the co-chair's CS and line up its column, and then you can take this interesting scenario here and add up this column, where do the two columns end up at?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, that's a really good question. But I would guess closest, because we would have to break this out, and it's based on estimated next year's numbers, that our 1% increase, our 2% increase in the original bill was between $6 and $7 million based on current prices. So this is going to be around $12 to $13 million in that round terms, because most of the income, again, is at the highest level. And then you're either keeping them equal or, you're kind of averaging out the lower ones. You're eliminating some taxpayers, which is it's a policy choice, but it is another $9 to $10 million at current prices over what the co-chair CS was.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Cost of doing business higher in Alaska than the other states used as an example. I mean, it's just going to. It's not useful because it's a whole lot higher here the cars are doing business there than it is down in the lower 48. It's because of transportation and other costs. Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out, but these taxes are net profits, so even though it could be more expensive, they're not paying any taxes until they have a profit, and this is on the net profit.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the moving up and getting rid of the burden on the smaller taxpayers. I think that's a good idea, and I think that the rationale for a graduated rate makes a lot more sense, and leaving all those off under 100,000 probably takes away burden on the department as well, because the department is having to do a lot of taxpayer information and taxpayer forms for not a lot of money, but it has to be compensated somewhere, and I still look at trying to figure out where we're going to get income for the state if we don't raise the rate on those most profitable companies to correspond with some reasonable return. So I'm going to support this amendment.
Any Representative Heron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Full disclosure here, you know, I'm a little guy, you know, when it comes to mining claims, but I like other miners, we would like this proposal, but unfortunately, even though it is onerous to do it, you know, to pay those, they're relatively small for our operation, but you know, it goes back to what the legislature did how many years ago when we essentially abolished the income tax. And so I'm averse to not requiring the little guys to pay taxes as well, because we fall into that same thing where it's always easy to undo a tax, and it's a lot harder to create a tax. And so I guess I like the status quo.
Any other comments? Representative Olson.
I'm just wondering if 5, 6, and 7 amendments, 5, 6, and 7 might be something that would be appropriate to the working group, or the proposed working group. Thank
you. Any further comments? No? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just need to come back to, you know, our big problem here is we are going to have to get revenue from somewhere. And if we're going to say that we're not going to tax profitable companies, and this is only a net profit tax, and we're not going to tax the most profitable ones, that means we're going to be taking more out of the permanent fund dividend allowances. And so when we talk about, you know, how are we going to work on the budget for the state, we have to, what are the alternatives? I mean, there's got to be some alternative to not spend money we don't have. And so I just it seems like this may be one of those things. I agree with Representative Olson that if we're not doing it here, it'll be we'll need to contemplate it for the future. But it seems to me that we do have a process we're in right now considering bills, and we're here for looking at revenue, and that's got to be significant revenue, otherwise we're not going to make any headway on reducing our $4 billion budget deficit. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? I appreciate the ideas and the concepts. I think that a 56% tax increase in one fell swoop is probably, for a guy like me, is considered to be incredibly steep for that highest bracket. That's kind of, if we jump from 7 to 11, I think we're above 55%.
Any further discussion? Wrap up? Representative Josephson?
Yes, I'll be swift.
Just to clarify the record, the committee minutes from February 15th, I said South Dakota taxed at 14%. I was unsure of Wisconsin. The committee minutes, to the extent they're right, and to the extent Mr. Burnett was right, I bet he was. He's sitting there. I wouldn't say anything else. South Dakota is 10% on profits. Wisconsin is 3 to 15% progressive tax, that's what this is, on net mining proceeds, which sounds like profits to me. So I think it's reasonable, and I'm also looking at a document from Legislative Research I'd be happy to share. It's February 3rd, 2011. It says the resource value is just one indicator in 2009 of all mineral extraction is approaching, it's just under $2.5 billion. The government revenue was $67 million. Now, again, concentrate, if you gave me a pile of concentrate, I'd walk away, foolishly, I suppose, but I wouldn't know what to do with it. So I understand that those are very different things, but I... otherwise, I just would echo what Representative Seaton said. Thank you.
Is your objection maintained?
Yes.
Yes? Thank you. Would the Secretary call the roll, please, for Amendment Number 6?
Okay. Amendment Number 6. Representative Chenault?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
Representative Herron?
No.
Co-Chair Tallarico?
No.
Co-Chair Nagia?
No.
3 yea, 5 nay.
Thank you. Amendment number 6 has failed. We have amendment number 7, Representative Tarr.
Pardon me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 7.
Thank you. Amendment number 7 has been moved. Is there an objection?
Object. For discussion.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The previous two amendments kind of set up the discussion for this one. After looking over, you know, the original bill, the committee substitute, then going back and looking at some legislation that had been introduced in prior years, you know, there were kind of several different options about how these brackets could be done. And so what you'll see in this amendment is just a slightly different approach. It keeps everything under 100,000 at 3%, unlike the you know, the legislation under consideration right now. The 40 to 50 folks are at 3%, but then from 50 to 100 it's a $1,500 plus 5%. So again, it's kind of shifting what we might consider as small operator, you know, to $100,000 and under. But I wanted to keep that in there, kind of like what Representative Herron was just saying, that those individuals are currently taxpayers, and also it does give the department some understanding of the activity that's being done, and that can be, I think, instructive in us planning and making sure that we have staff to help get those projects going. And then it makes some slight adjustments in the categories going forward, and adds, instead of just over 100,000, the 102 to 250, the 250 to 500, the 500 to 1,000, and a million, or pardon me, 500 to a million and a million over. The chart that I passed out will show you, in comparison to the current statute and what is proposed in this amendment, it's not a tax increase for anyone under $800,000 in net profits on an annual basis. For everyone under $800,000 net profit, it's actually a tax decrease, anywhere in the $1,200 to $5,200 range. So for the folks right around $700,000, it's about $1,200, $1,200 less, and kind of the max difference on the low side is that $5,200 that you see. So for the smaller operators, it's actually a tax decrease, but where it is an increase is for the folks at $800,000 and above. So for net profits of $800,000, it'd be about $800 more per year in taxes. For net profits of $900,000, it'd be about $2,000 more in taxes. For someone who gets over that $1 million threshold, say a $1.1 million net profits, that person would pay about $8,800 more. And then those were some additional calculations I did that aren't on the table, but you'll see on the table my high end there, the $1,500,000, that operator would pay about $24,000 more in taxes on an annual basis. So kind of spreads out those income brackets a little bit relative to the legislation and the current statute. I think, again, that could be helpful in helping us understand the relative size of different projects and who's doing work. I know what we were just told was, you know, there's the 14 projects that fall in the $100,000 and above. And we did get some information about the $1 million folks. So, you know, within there, there's probably not a lot of activity, but for a lot of those individuals, it would end up being a tax decrease. And again, it would just shift it on the higher end. And I think for some of the reasons that have been previously stated, just looking at something, since it's been, you know, six decades or so, I think, since we've made these any significant changes, something that would be durable relative to the dollars that are spent in 2016 going forward. And, you know, I think that was something that was sufficiently covered by the Council of Alaska Producers and others that, you know, that these large-size projects are expensive. But also want to have folks keep in context that the committee substitute still retains a 3-year tax holiday. So all new mining operations are exempt from the tax levied by this chapter for 3 years after production begins. So even for the folks, if you had a large-scale project, you still have a 3-year tax holiday, and it, you know, I would imagine that in your early years you'd fall into those, you know, perhaps transitioning in those lower tax brackets, but you'd have that 3-year holiday before you got to the higher one.
Discussion?
Yes.
Representative Heron.
To the commissioner, of course, Representative Tarr talks about the current statute. Then we have the governor's proposed, then we have the CS. By taking this, which I appreciate, it's a good illustration. What's the difference? What's the net difference between all those?
Through the chair to Representative Heron, just quick back of the napkin in my head calculations. The total on this is going to be very much the same as the previous amendment, because most of the revenue is coming from the highest tax bracket. You know, most of the revenue by far is coming from the highest tax bracket in any proposal. And if you look at the chart that we handed out earlier in our discussions, back probably February 15th or so, or maybe the 19th, whenever it was, that showed the various incomes between, you know, small to the very largest ones over the $100,000. There's nearly all the incomes up at that million plus.
Thank you. Any other questions? A wrap up, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just looking back, I was running some numbers when we had amendment number 5 in front of us. And, you know, even when you get up into $10 million of net profit, according to, you know, the numbers that I ran here, that's about a $90,000 difference in taxes. But that's on $10 million of profit. So, $10 million of profit is a net profit is pretty hefty sum, and it would be hard for me to think that would be overly burdensome, you know, increase $90,000. So I think, you know, the cost of things have definitely changed. That's true on the state side as well as perhaps on the industry side. But still, even when you get into these very large net profits, it's not a really, really large number. And I would just think that if you're, you know, got $10 million in net profits, you've covered your costs, you know, and you've still got $10 million in net profits, that's a company that can afford, you know, what I would consider a pretty modest tax increase.
Thank you. Is your objection maintained?
Maintained.
Thank you. Would the secretary call the roll, please, for amendment number 7?
Okay, roll call vote for amendment 7. Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Chenault?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
Co-chair Tallarico?
No.
Co-chair Nadia?
No.
3 yea, 5 nay.
Thank you. Amendment number 7 has failed. We will move to amendment number 8. Representative Josephson?
Thank you. I move amendment 8.
Amendment 8 has been moved. Is there an objection?
I'll object.
Thank you. Representative Olson objects. Representative Josephson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, what this does, this amendment does, the effect of it, is to defer the tax exemption for a mine in its first 3 years of production. The testimony that I heard in February again was that these mines enjoy a tax holiday for 3 years, 3.5 years. And I can't think of anything analogous to that in the oil and gas industry. There is the gross value reduction, that's 20%. There are lots of credits. We saw them add up to 85%. When prices were low, we saw them go higher than that. But we always enjoyed 15%. Generally, we enjoyed 35, 40%, maybe more. If, for example, a mine like Pebble is worth the tens of billions of dollars that that its leaseholder or owner says it is, then it strikes me that we're waiving a lot of revenue. In fact, there was a gentleman that testified in February and mentioned Pebble specifically. I could find it in the minutes. And he believed the state would enjoy $200 million a year just from the Pebble mine. So unless I'm wrong and I haven't understood the statute correctly that creates this tax exemption, that's $600 million for a mine the size of Pebble that we just wouldn't see. In fact, at 3.5 years, it would be $700 million. This amendment transforms the tax exemption for mining operations first 3 years after production into a tax deferral with a 10-year payoff. So if an operation owes, hypothetically, $100 in taxes for each of 3 years, or $300 total, that $300 would be divided by 10 for the decade after production. The company would pay $30 a year for those 10 years, in addition to things like the mining license tax. Or I guess the fee that we're talking about, really. This amendment works in conjunction with other amendments by I think aiding a small producer who doesn't have revenue, and they could defer their small taxes spread out over many numbers of years. It also provides the same aid to companies trying to recover their startup costs and have quicker cash flow and generates revenue for the state. And I would note that there was a lot of discussion between principally Representative Seaton and whomever was testifying about the purpose of the tax credit. The tax credit was usable over, I think, a 15-year span, but was really for exploration and development, and you weren't getting any revenue at exploration and development, so it's hard to argue. I mean, the industry can argue, yes, but on the back end, we have this anticipatory benefit. But in terms of the front end, you don't get any tangible credit in year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and on. So it's hard to argue that it would deter, I think, new exploration. It doesn't, quote, pull the rug out, close quote, because the tax deferral would be there and gradualized rather than a full exemption. And so I'm offering this amendment. Thank you.
Any discussion? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back about 2005 or so, we had a Ways and Means Committee worked for a couple of different sessions on mining tax bill, and this was one of the provisions that came out of there, and it was looking at deferral and sediment exemption so that it would help mines on the front end, that they would recover their costs earlier, but that the state wouldn't lose its tax money, because after they became more profitable and recovered their costs, then they would still pay the tax, but it would be over time when they were in their more profitable state. So I'll support this, because I think that we need to move from giving away a lot of credits that we are not having any money to afford, to saying that we'll hold an expense, but you know, you still need to pay your tax at some point in the future time. So thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other discussion? This might be best directed towards Mr. Fogels. Does the exemption clock start the day a person receives their mining license? Is that that we, you know, currently we have the 3.5 year exemption. The CS has a 3 year, and people, of course, have to do the application and they receive a mining license. My assumption is the way that it's written and the way it is in statute, the day they receive that mining license, the clock starts to tick on the exemption. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, the exemption, the 3.5 year exemption from tax begins on the day production starts.
Production starts, and not when they expire.
When the Department of Natural Resources certifies to the Department of Revenue that production is starting.
Okay.
Under the tax.
That was something that I needed clarified. Because actually, the way it's written in the bill, it kind of leads you to believe that the day that you're issued a license, the clock starts. But we do it on the day of production.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's because the mining tax is a mining license tax, and so it's the mining license really has to do with the payment of the first tax return.
Okay. And then just one other question. You guys might not have these details because we're discussing the financing and the money. Most of these people are in their wheelhouse of money in their first 3 years of production, or does that usually come later?
Mr. Chair, typically a new mine is going to, you know, have to pay back some of those initial capital costs, which are pretty significant in the mining world. So, I mean, it varies from mine to mine, but, you know, a lot of that is done in those early years. So most of the profits will come later in the mine life.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure on page one, this is draft, the N version, I think, our committee substitute, mm-hmm. line nine, it says after production begins. Mm-hmm. And so that just for me was more referencing, and I just want to make sure that's the right section that I was looking at.
I think I just wanted to make sure it was very clear, because you could read it a couple of different ways, but it's very clear up front there that's how it goes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? Representative Herron.
Yes, to the two commissioners, does the administration have a position on this amendment?
Representative Herron, to the chair, we have not taken a position on this amendment. The 3 year or 3.5 year deferral, which is 3 years in the CS, is not likely to impact any major mine in the next several years, and so it's not with the money from this is not within our fiscal note or in the time period that we're looking at. So I think it's something that certainly can be looked at over time. It's not something that's that important. There is one thing that Representative Josephson, when he was talking about Pebble Mine and the $200 million a year, that $200 million a year estimate would have included corporate income tax and royalties, because that's on state land. So it wouldn't have been a a $600 million deferral or exemption, because they still would have been paying corporate income tax. And so it, just for the record, I don't want people to think that they would have been giving up that much in the deferral or exemption.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Maybe a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So looking at the structure of this amendment, the mechanics of it, would it be valuable to have this for the future?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, actually, you know, this is conceptually similar to some of the proposals we've made with the tax credits in the oil and gas area, where we're talking about paying less than the full amount. And that is in the governor's bill, not in the CS that passed out of this committee necessarily. But a cap on that, and then deferring it to production at some time in the future. So it might well be a very valuable structure to look at, you know, in terms of that.
Any further discussion? Wrap-up, Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate Mr. Burnett's comments. They do clarify, and he's absolutely right. I hadn't looked again at this. Page 20, the February 19th hearing, Mr. Jason Brunet said that Pebble might earn the state and local governments $200 million. I'm hearing great things about Donlin, that it could be larger than anticipated. I'm sort of quickly trying to see what part of what we receive from mining is corporate income tax versus the mining license tax. I have almost an excess of information sometimes. But I still think that we don't do anything this generous for the oil and gas industry. So let's spread this out. Let's not allow ourselves to have no mining license tax when, for all we know, the ore body is at its best in year 1, 2, and 3. I don't think, with the exception of perhaps a couple of gentlemen or gentleladies in the room, I don't think that we really understand that. And I don't think that the state can afford to just give a tax holiday for 3 or 3.5 years. I think deferring this over a decade makes more sense. Thanks.
Okay. Is the objection still maintained?
It's mine, and with your indulgence, can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
I did not receive these amendments till I walked in today, and given the fact that they are tax amendments, I always try to err on the side of caution, and if we could get them out to where we have them a little bit, you know, maybe 24 hours, it'll make it a lot easier for somebody like me that likes to read them twice and make notes, and I'm always going to err on the side of caution if I haven't had adequate time, and with that, I'll still maintain my objection.
Okay. Thank you. The objection is maintained on amendment number 8. Could the secretary call the roll, please?
Amendment 8. Representative Tarr.
Yes.
Representative Herron.
No.
Representative Chenault.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Seaton.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Co-chair Tallarico.
No.
Co-chair Nahia.
No.
3 yea, 5 nay.
Thank you. Amendment number 8 has failed.
Move Amendment 9, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Amendment number 9 has been moved. Is there an objection to Amendment number 9?
I'll object.
Object. Representative Olson has objected. Representative Josephson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment increases the minimum rental rate, which hasn't been modified for 16 years, I'm told. And it would increase that rate for mining rental rates other than coal. Currently, the statute requires mining rent to be not less than 50 cents an acre for the first 5 years and $2.50 an acre after that. It is
it must be in that range, but it's negotiable between the parties. This increases rent to be not less than $1.65 for the first 5 years and $3.30 after that. This amount establishes parity between the state and private landowners who charge higher rental rates. And I could try to find my source of information on that, but my understanding is that private rental rates are higher. This hasn't been adjusted in 16 years, and I would need to get input from the department about its fiscal impact. I suspect it's modest. Someone might query, then why are we doing it? I don't know how modest it is, and I think that it's an opportunity cost. This land we can't use for anything else. It's occupied, and really occupied, unlike other activities. And so I think it's a reasonable amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't seen this amendment here. I know we were looking at some of this in the previous, you know, in 6 years ago, and at that time we were putting in this, it's in statute, we were just putting in the adjustments really that had been already made. So I'd like to ask DNR whether these are what the current rates are that are rental rates that are being negotiated or where they've escalated to at the current time.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I guess I need to hear your question one more time. I mean, I see the bill. The bill shows the current rates right now for annual claim rentals that are being deleted and is replacing them. If you look at on page two, if you look at the section that's deleted, that's the current rental rate. You can see, if you look at the far right column, it says rental amount for each mining claim or leasehold location, including each quarter section. It says $20 for each mining claim for the first 5 years, then jumps to 40 for 6 to 10 years, and then 100 for 11 or more. Under this amendment with the new per acreage amount, the claim rentals for 0 to 5 years and 6 to 10 years would jump to $66 a year, and then after 11 years it would jump from $100 to $132 a year. Rough calculation, having just seen this amendment.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. So by regulation you haven't adjusted these rates over the years so that these acreage rental rates are still the same as where they were set there, or have they been adjusted for inflation over the years?
I don't believe they've been adjusted, but I'd have to get back to the committee on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Okay, sure.
And then Mr. Fogel said a quarter section is just that. That's just a straight across fee, right? That's 40 acres.
40 acres, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, particularly for Mr. Fogles? Representative Herr?
So, to follow up on Representative Seaton's question, Commissioner, aren't you supposed to review that and follow inflation, or is it whenever?
Oh, I now that I'm thinking about it, I do believe we probably have looked at this, but again, I can't give you the details as to when we've looked at it and if we've actually adjusted the claim rentals right now. I'd have to get back to the committee on that.
Yeah, I guess a comment, Mr. Chairman, that it's on this one particularly, it seems like we'd want to have a mechanism to allow the department by regulation to at least keep up with inflation rather than going to the legislature in any given year and creating a law. Maybe we want to make sure the legislature is involved in inflation amounts for this.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to go back to your comment that you were thinking you had made adjustments, because the way I'm reading this, it's
doesn't allow that opportunity in the current statute. So I'm just wondering how that would have happened.
Again, Representative Tarr, I would have to get back to the committee on whether we've made adjustments or not, and I do not, I'm not prepared to answer that question at this time.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Maybe to the sponsor, I can ask him the figure that you have was what the what's the significance behind the increase? I mean, can you tell me what? Maybe I'm reading it wrong. We're going from 50 cents an acre to $1.65.
Yeah. I would have to ask my assistant. We could do that. I don't know if she contacted Ms. Naumann. Well, she clearly contacted Ms. Naumann at Ledge Legal about this. So I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, the 250 to 330 looks more like sort of a reflection of inflation, but I don't know.
Any other questions or comments? Wrap up?
No wrap up, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Thank you. Is the objection maintained?
Maintained.
Okay, thank you. Would the Secretary call the roll, please?
Okay, roll call vote on Amendment 9. Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
Representative Herron?
No.
Representative Chenault?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Seaton?
No.
Co-Chair Tallarico?
No.
Co-Chair Nadia?
No.
Two yay, six nay.
Thank you very much. Amendment number 9 has failed. And we are at 3 o'clock. We have a meeting coming in behind us. So I want to inform the committee we are going to recess until tomorrow at 1 p.m. So we're going to bring this meeting into recess, and we will come back and meet here in this room at 1 p.m. and continue on to finish up the amendments for House Bill 253. So we are in recess.